Commonwealth. It wasn't a crime or even a sin, but it didn't speak to a rock-solid foundation in their marriage either. How could she mistrust him this fast after she'd been singing his praises just this afternoon to Melissa? Their marriage, unlike those of so many of their friends, was strong, wasn't it? What was a strong marriage? What was a good marriage? She knew terrible people who had wonderful marriages, glued together somehow in their terribleness. And she knew fine, fine people who'd stood before God and all their friends to profess their undying love to each other, only to toss that love on a slag heap a few years later. In the end, no matter how good they were or thought they were, usually all that remained of the love they'd so publicly professed was vitriol, regret, and a kind of awed dismay at how dark the roads they'd ventured down became by the end. A marriage, her mother often said, was only as strong as your next fight. Rachel didn't believe that, or didn't want to, not when it came to her and Brian. When it came to her and Sebastian, that had definitely been true. But she and Sebastian were a disaster from the start. She and Brian were anything but. Yet in the absence of a logical reason why she would stumble across a man who looked like her husband and was dressed identically slipping out of the back of a building in Boston when her husband was supposed to be on a flight to London, she had to go with the only rational answer, that the man exiting the Hancock early this afternoon had been Brian, which meant he wasn't in London, which meant he was lying. She flagged down a cab. Chapter 15. Wet. I don't want him to be lying, she thought as the cab crossed the BU bridge and rounded the rotary to turn onto Memorial Drive. I don't want to believe any of this. I want to feel exactly as I did this weekend, in love and in trust. But what is my alternative? Pretend I didn't see him? This wouldn't be the first time you saw something that wasn't there. Those times were different. How? They just were. The cab driver never said a word during the drive. She glanced at his hack license. Sanjay Seth. He looked sullen in the photo, one step short of scowling. She didn't know this man, and yet she allowed him to transport her just as she allowed strangers to prepare her food and go through her trash and give her a body scan and fly a plane. And she hoped they didn't fly that plane into a mountain or poison her food just because they were having a bad day. Or, in the case of this cab, she hoped he wouldn't accelerate and drive her to a remote spot at the back of a failed industrial park and climb in the back seat, telling her just what he thought of women who didn't say please. The last time she'd taken a cab, this line of thinking had compelled her to abort the ride, but this time she pressed her fists into the sides of her thighs and kept them there. She maintained a steady inhale and exhale that was neither too deep nor too shallow, and looked out the window at the rain and told herself she'd get through this just like she got through the subway ride and the mall. When they neared Harvard Square, she asked Sanjay Seth to pull over at the corner of JFK and Winthrop, because Winthrop was a one-way, heading in the wrong direction. She didn't feel like waiting while the cab slogged through 450 traffic for another 5 or 10 minutes to come around the block just so he could get her 100 feet closer. As she approached the building, Caleb Perloff exited it. He tugged on the door to make sure it had locked behind him, his raincoat and socks ball cap as wet as everyone else's in the city, and then turned to see her standing on the sidewalk below him. She could tell by the look on his face that he couldn't put the two together. Rachel, here on the other side of the river in Cambridge, outside their offices, when Brian was overseas. She felt ridiculous. What possible explanation could she have for standing here? She'd had the cab ride over to think about it, and she hadn't managed to come up with one viable reason she'd need access to her husband's office. "So this is where it all happens," she tried. Caleb shot her that wry smile of his.
"This is the spot."
He craned his head to look up at the building, and then back at her.
"Did you know that the price of timber went down 0.1 cent yesterday in Andhra Pradesh?"
"I did not, no."
"But on the other side of the world, in Mato Grosso,
That's where again?
Brazil.
He rolled the R as he came down the steps toward her.
In Mato Grosso, the price rose 0.5 cent, and all signs point to it continuing to rise over the next month.
But in India?
We get that 0.1 cent discount.
He shrugged.
But it's also kind of volatile right now, and shipping costs are higher. So who do we make a deal with?
That's a dilemma, she admitted.
And what about all the timber we export?
Another wrinkle.
Can't just let it rot.
Couldn't do that.
Let the bugs get to it, the rain.
Heavens, the rain. He held his hand up to it, a soft drizzle at the moment.
Actually, it's been dry in BC this past month. Odd, dry there, wet here, usually works the other way.
He cocked his head at her. She cocked hers at him.
Brings you by, Rachel.
She never knew how much Brian had told anyone about her condition. He'd said he didn't mention it, but she figured he had to tell someone, if only after a few drinks. They had to wonder at some point why Rachel hadn't been able to join them at this party or that, why she'd skipped out on the 4th of July fireworks with everyone last year at the Esplanade, why they rarely saw her out at the bars. Someone as bright as Caleb would have realized at some point that the only time he saw Rachel was in controlled environments, usually the condo, with small groups. But did Caleb know she hadn't driven a car in 2 years, hadn't taken the subway in almost as long prior to this past Saturday? Did he know she once froze in the food court of the Prudential Center Mall? That she'd had to sit, surrounded by well-meaning security personnel, short of breath and certain she'd pass out until Brian arrived to take her home? I was shopping in the hood. She gestured toward the square. He looked at her empty hands. Couldn't find a thing, she said. Turned into a browse day. She squinted through the mist at the building behind him. Thought I'd take a look at the competition for my husband's attentions. He smiled.
Wanna come up?
I'll just pop into his office to... He left something in his drawer that he... So this is his command center. Mind if I just hang out here for a bit? You can close the door behind you. Did you remodel? She said.
Nope.
Then there's nothing I need to see. Just thought I'd stroll by before I headed home. He nodded as if it all made perfect sense.
Want to share a cab?
That'd be great. They walked back up Winthrop and crossed JFK. It was close to 5 and the traffic heading into Harvard Square had clotted. To catch a cab heading out of the square, their best chance was to walk a block to the Charles Hotel. But what had been a flat, pewter sky just a minute before had turned swollen and black.
That's not good,
Caleb said. I wouldn't think so, no. They came to the end of Winthrop and could see from there that the cab stand in front of the Charles was empty. The traffic snaking toward the river was as bad as, if not worse than, the traffic heading into the square. The black above rumbled. A few miles to the west, a bolt of lightning split the sky.
A drink,
Caleb said. Or two, she said as the sky opened. Jesus. The umbrellas were poor protection once the wind kicked in. The rain fell with weight and clatter, the drops exploding off the pavement as they ran back up Winthrop. It sliced in from the right and the left, the front and the back.
Grendel's or Shay's,
Caleb said. She could see Shay's on the other side of JFK, close but still another 50 yards in the rain, and if traffic moved, they'd have to work their way to a crosswalk. Grendel's, on the other hand, was just to their left. Grendel's.
Good choice. We're too old for Shay's anyway.
In the vestibule, they added their umbrellas to the dozen or so already leaning against the wall. They removed their coats and Caleb took off his sox cap, which had soaked through. His brown hair was cut so tight to his scalp, he freed it of moisture by swiping his palm across it. They found a place to hang their coats by the hostess stand, and were led to a table. Grendel's den was a basement-level place, and they ordered their first round as shoes of every variety ran past on the cobblestones outside. Soon the rain had grown so heavy, no one ran past. Grendel's had been around so long that not only could Rachel recall being turned away from the door with a fake ID in the 90s, but her mother had recalled frequenting the place in the early 70s. It catered mostly to Harvard students and faculty. Out-of-towners tended to wander in only on summer days when management placed tables out front by the green. The waitress brought a wine for Rachel and a bourbon for Caleb and left menus. Caleb used his napkin to blot his face and neck dry. They both chuckled a few times without saying anything. It could be years before they saw rain like this again. "How's the baby?" she asked.
He beamed. "She's magical. I mean, for the first 90 days, their eyes don't really lock on to anything besides the breast and the mother's face, so I was starting to feel left out. But on that 91st day, A.B. looked right at me, and I was a goner."
Caleb and Haya had named their 6-month-old Annabelle, but Caleb had been referring to her as A.B. since the second week of her life.
"Well,"
Caleb raised his glass.
"Cheers."
She met his glass with her own. "To dodging pneumonia."
"We hope,"
he said. They drank. "How's Haya?"
"She's good."
Caleb nodded.
"Real good. Loves being a mom."
"How's her English coming?"
"She watches a ton of TV. It really helps. You can have a solid conversation with her now if you have a little patience. She's very deliberate about choosing her words."
Caleb had returned from a trip to Japan with Haya. He spoke halting Japanese. She spoke barely any English. They were married within 3 months. Brian didn't like it. Caleb wasn't the settling down type, he'd say. And what were they going to talk about over the dinner table? Rachel had to admit that it colored her opinion of Caleb when he introduced her to the luminous, mostly mute, subservient woman with the kind of face and body that could launch a thousand wet dreams. What else had bound him to her, if not that and that alone? And was the master-servant vibe she got when she saw them together an outgrowth of some hidden He-Man fantasy he'd always secretly pursued? Or was Rachel just being bitchy because it hadn't escaped her notice that while Caleb had married a woman who didn't speak English, his partner, Brian, had married a shut-in? When she brought that up to Brian, he said,
"It's different with us."
"How?"
"You're not a shut-in."
"I beg to differ."
"You're just going through a phase. You'll rebound. But him? Having a kid? The fuck's that all about? He is a kid."
"Why does it bother you so much?"
"It doesn't bother me so much," he said. "It's just not the right time in his life."
"How did they meet?" she said.
"You know the story. He went to Japan on a deal and came back with her. Didn't come back with the deal, by the way. He got undercut by some..."
"But how does he just come back with a Japanese citizen? I mean, there are immigration laws designed to keep people from just popping into our country and deciding to stay."
"Not if she's here on a legal visa and he marries her."
"But it doesn't strike you as odd? She meets him over there and just decides to chuck her life aside and join him in America, a country she's never seen, where people speak a language she doesn't know?" He gave it some thought.
"You've got a point. What's your theory, then?"
"Internet order bride?"
"Don't they all come from the Philippines and Vietnam?"
"Not all."
"Huh,"
Brian said.
"Internet order bride. The more I think of it, I wouldn't put it past him. We're back to my point. Caleb's not mature enough for marriage, so he picks someone he barely knows who can barely communicate."
"Love's love," she said, throwing one of his own preferred bromides back at him. He grimaced.
"Love's love until you toss kids into the mix. Then it becomes a business partnership with guaranteed economic instability."
It wasn't that he didn't have a point, but she did wonder if he was talking about himself in those moments, about his fears regarding the fragility of their own relationship and the potential calamity that could be wrought by bringing a child into it. An icy thought slid through her before she could stop it. "Oh, Brian, have I ever really known you?" Caleb was giving her a curious smile from the other side of the table, as if to ask, "Where did you go?" Her phone vibrated on the table. Brian. She resisted the childish impulse to ignore it. "Hey."
"Hey," he said warmly. "Sorry about earlier. Friggin' thing just died.
Then I was worried I'd forgotten my adapters, but I did not, my wife, and here we are. She got out of the booth, moved a few feet away. Here we are.
Where are you at?
Grendel's.
Where?
That college bar by your office.
I'd know it, I just can't figure out how you turned up there.
I'm with Caleb.
Okay. Help me out here. What's going on?
Nothing's going on. Why would something be going on? It's raining like holy hell, but otherwise just grabbing a drink with your partner.
Well, that's great. What brought you over to Harvard Square?
A wild hair. It had been a while. I got an urge to visit some bookstores. I went with it. Where are you staying this time? I forgot.
Covent Garden. You said it looked like a place Graham Greene would have liked.
When did I say that?
When I sent you a picture last time. No, 2 times ago.
Send me one now. As soon as the words left her mouth, adrenaline flooded her blood as if poured from a bucket.
What?
A picture.
It's 10 o'clock at night.
A selfie from the lobby, then.
Hmm?
Just send me a picture of you. Another sunburst of adrenaline exploded at the center of her. I miss you.
Okay.
You'll do that?
Yeah, sure.
A pause, and then...
Everything okay?
She laughed, and it sounded shrill to her own ears. Everything is fine. Perfectly fine. Why do you keep asking?
You just sound funny.
Tired, I guess, she said. All this rain.
So we'll talk in the morning, then.
Sounds great.
Love you.
Love you, too. She hung up and went back to the booth. Caleb looked up as she sat, his thumb working his cell phone keypad as he gave her a smile. She was a little amazed at people who could do the talk-with-one-person-text-with-another trick. It was usually computer geeks and tech nerds like, well, Caleb.
How's he doing?
He sounded good. Tired, but good. Do you ever go on any of these trips? Caleb shook his head and continued tapping away on his phone.
He's the voice of the company. Him and his old man. He also has the business acumen. I just keep the trains running on time.
Are you demurring?
Hell no.
After a few more distracted seconds, he pocketed his phone. He folded his hands on the table, looked at her to let her know she had his full attention again.
Without me and people like me in the here and now, that 200-year-old lumber firm wouldn't last 6 more months. Sometimes, not every day, but sometimes, the speed of a transaction can save a couple, $3 million. It's that fluid out there.
He waved his fingers at the global there. The waitress returned, and they ordered another round. Caleb opened the menu.
Do you mind if I eat? I walked in the office at 10 this morning and didn't get up from my desk again until I walked out at 5.
Sure.
You?
I could eat. The waitress returned with their drinks and took their orders. As she left, Rachel noticed a man around the same age as Brian, 40 or so, sitting with an older woman who gave off a stylish, professorial air. She could have been 60, yet it was a sexy-as-hell 60. Normally, Rachel would have studied her to see what about her gave off that impression so forcefully. Was it her clothes, the way she sat, the cut of her hair, the intelligence in her face? But instead, Rachel focused on the man. He had sandy blonde hair going gray over the ears and hadn't shaved in a couple of days. He drank a beer and sported a gold wedding band. He also wore exactly what her husband had worn this morning, sans the raincoat, blue jeans, white t-shirt, black pullover sweater with an upturned collar. Was this what she'd missed, being holed up so much of her time? It wasn't like she didn't get out, but she certainly didn't get out much. Maybe she'd overlooked the prevalence of some styles. When had all men decided, for example, to stop shaving until every 3rd or 4th day? When had half fedoras and pork pie hats come back into style? Where did the brightly colored tennis shoes spring from? When was the moment all casual bicyclists decided they should dress in skin-tight spandex, replete with brand names all over the shirts and leggings, as if they required corporate sponsorship to pedal to Starbucks? Back when Rachel had been in college, hadn't every 3rd boy worn a plaid shirt, V-neck tee, and ripped jeans? If she went to the hotel bars frequented by middle-aged Republican salesmen right now, how many would be dressed in light blue Oxford shirts and tan pants? So, by that metric, wasn't it entirely possible that the combination of dark pullover, white t-shirt, and blue jeans, which had probably never gone fully in or out of style, basic as it was, could be worn by three men in Boston, Cambridge on the same day? If she walked through a mall right now, she'd probably see it on a couple more, not to mention on the mannequins fronting the J. Crew and Vince stores. Their food arrived. Caleb made short work of his burger, and she devoured her salad. She hadn't realized how hungry she was. When they'd both cleaned their plates, they sat in the warmth of the low lights and gathering dusk. The rain had let up, and a steady stream of footsteps returned to the cobblestones just above their heads as people ventured back out into the evening. His smile wrapped around his bourbon as he raised the glass to his lips. She could feel the wine when she smiled back. They'd shared a moment, no more than that, when she'd first been dating Brian. In a pantry at the apartment of a friend of Brian's in the Fenway. Rachel had gone into the pantry for olives. Caleb had been coming out with stoned wheat thins, if she remembered correctly, and they'd paused as their bodies passed. Their eyes met, and neither dropped their gaze. Then it became something of a challenge. Who literally would blink first? "Hi," she'd said.
"Hi."
The word stumbled out of the back of his throat. Vasoconstriction, she remembered thinking. The process by which skin capillaries constrict in order to elevate core body temperature, corresponding increase in respiratory rate and heartbeat, a flush to the skin. She'd leaned toward him at the same moment he'd leaned toward her, and their heads touched, her breasts pressed against his chest, the edge of his right hand brushed the edge of her left on its way to her hip. Of all the places their bodies met in that second or two, it was most intimate when his hand grazed hers. When that hand found her hip, she turned away and sidestepped deeper into the pantry. He let out a small sound, some hybrid hiccup laugh of amazement and exasperation and embarrassment, and was gone from the pantry in the time it took for her to look back. Vasodilation? When the core body temperature is too high, blood vessels below the skin dilate so heat can escape the body and core temperature can be restored. It took her almost 5 minutes to figure out where the fucking olives were. She sipped her wine, and Caleb sipped his bourbon, and the bar filled up around them. Soon they couldn't see the door. In the past, that could have easily shot bolts of anxiety into her bloodstream, but tonight it only made things seem warmer, more intimate.
"How's Brian been handling all this rain?"
Caleb asked. "You know him. Positive mental attitude. He's the only person in the city who hasn't bitched about it yet." Caleb shook his head.
"Same at the office. We're all drowning. He's like, it creates a mood."
She finished the sentence with him. "He says the same thing at home. I'm like, what mood? Abject depression?" He says, "No, it's fun. It's sexy." I said, "Honey, it was fun and sexy on day one, and that was 10 days ago." Caleb chuckled into his glass, took a drink.
"Man would find a silver lining in a concentration camp. You don't see barbed wire of that quality in other death camps. Plus, the shower heads are top-notch."
Rachel drank some more wine. "It's awesome."
"It is awesome."
"But it can be exhausting."
"Wipe you the fuck out. I never met someone who needs positivity like that guy. And it's weird, because it's not like Hallmark positivity. It's just a can-do thing, you know?"
"Oh, I know. Do I ever know?" She smiled at the thought of her husband. Couldn't stand movies with bummer endings, books where the hero lost, songs about alienation.
"I get it," he'd said to her once. "I read Sartre in college. I had friends who dragged me to a Nine Inch Nails concert. The world's a pointless, chaotic mess where nothing means nothing. I do understand. I just choose not to engage that philosophy because it doesn't help me."
Brian, she'd long ago realized, with both admiration and irritation, didn't do depressing. He didn't do hopeless or bleak chic or whining. Brian did objectives and strategies and remedies. Brian did hope. Once, during an irritable mood, when Brian said, "Anything's possible," she said, "No, Brian, it's not. Curing world hunger is not possible. Flapping our arms to take flight is not possible." A small, strange fire grew in his eyes.
"No one's got long game anymore. Everyone wants it now."
"What are you even talking about?"
"That if you believe, really believe, and if your strategy is sound, and if you're willing to leave everything you've got on the field of battle to win the day,"
he held his arms wide,
"you can do anything."
She'd smiled at him and left the room before she'd be forced to decide if the man she'd married was just a tiny bit crazy. On the other hand, she never had to worry about him whining or bitching or kvetching in any way. Sebastian, no surprise, had been a whiner. A glass-half-empty negativist who showed in a thousand ways, both large and small, that he believed the world awoke every morning thinking about ways to urinate in his food. Brian, on the other hand, seemed to approach each day as if there was a present hidden somewhere within it, and if he didn't find it, there'd be no point bitching about it. Another Brianism? A complaint that's not looking for a solution is a disease that's not looking for a cure. Caleb said,
"He loves quoting that one at the office. I keep expecting to see it on a plaque someday, hanging in the waiting room."
You gotta admit, though, it really works for him. You ever known Brian to stay in a bad mood more than a few minutes? He nodded.
"I'll give you that. Why, some people would follow him into a burning cave. They just feel he'd get them out the other side somehow."
She liked that. It made her see her husband as heroic for a moment, a leader, an inspiration. She sat back in her chair, and Caleb sat back in his, and for a minute or so neither of them said a word.
"You look good," Caleb said eventually. "I mean, you always look good, but you look..."
She watched him search for the word. He found it.
"Secure."
Had anyone ever said that about her? Her mother used to say she rushed around so much she would have forgotten her head most days if it wasn't already attached. Two ex-boyfriends and her ex-husband had all told her she was anxious. In her 20s, alcohol, cigarettes, and books, always books, could anchor her in place. When she quit smoking, a treadmill replaced the window seat until her doctor, noting a rash of shin splints and a pretty significant weight drop in a body that was never in danger of being overweight, convinced her to complement the running with yoga. Worked well for a while, but the yoga eventually led to the visions, and the visions, post-Haiti, led to the panic attacks. Secure. No one had ever accused her of that. What could make Rachel Childs-Delacroix appear secure? Her phone vibrated by her elbow. A text from Brian. She opened it. She smiled. There stood Brian, still in the clothes he'd worn today, smiling big, if a bit blearily, his hair mussed from travel. Behind him, a facade of brown wainscoting, wide double doors, large yellow lanterns hanging from either side of the entrance, and above it all, the name of the establishment, Covent Garden Hotel. He'd sent her a few pictures of the street over the years, a curved, tidy London street of retail shops and restaurants, red brick and white trim. The doorman, or whoever took the photo, would have had to step off the sidewalk to get the full facade of the hotel into the frame. Brian was waving, a shit-eating grin dominating his handsome, weary face, as if letting her know he understood this wasn't just an ordinary selfie. She didn't just miss him. This had been a test of sorts. And damn, she thought as she slid the phone into her pocket, did you ever pass? She and Caleb did end up sharing a cab. He had the farther trip. He lived in the Seaport District. On the short ride back to her place, they kept the conversation on the rain and the effect on the local economy. The Red Sox, for example, were approaching a Major League Baseball record for rainouts. At her place, Caleb leaned in for the kiss to the cheek, and she was already turning away when his lips landed. In the condo, she took a shower, and the hot water, hitting skin pickled throughout the day by cold rain, was so exquisite it felt sinful. She closed her eyes and could see Caleb in the bar, and then in the pantry, and she flashed on Brian the last time they'd been in this shower together, just a few days ago, and he'd slipped up behind her and run the bar of soap over each nipple, then up one side of her neck and down the other, and caressed her abdomen with it in an ever-shrinking circle. She duplicated his efforts now, could feel him hardening between her legs. She could hear her own breathing mingle with the shower spray as Brian became Caleb, and Caleb became Brian, and she dropped the soap to the tile and placed one hand to the wall. She thought of Brian in the shower the other day, and Brian in front of the Covent Garden Hotel, that shit-eating grin of his, those blue eyes filled with boyish glee. Caleb vanished. She used a single finger to bring herself to a climax that moved through her body as if the hot water had entered her and flushed her capillaries. After, she lay in bed and was drifting to sleep when an odd thought occurred to her. When he'd decided to order dinner, Caleb had said he'd spent the entire day, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., behind his desk. Said he never got up, never went out. But when she'd shown up outside the building, he'd just been exiting. He still hadn't stepped out from under the overhang above the door. Yet his coat and his hat had been soaking wet. Chapter 16. Re-entry. Friday. The return. She thought about picking him up at the airport, but she didn't own a car anymore. She'd sold it when she moved in with Brian. The condo came with only one parking spot. After that, she'd driven zip cars if she needed to get somewhere. She couldn't believe how convenient they were, actually. One lot was within a block of the condo, but then came the Dunkin' Donuts and the food court and the vomiting on the Scientologist. After that, Brian asked her not to drive for a bit. When it came time to renew her license, they had one of their fiercer fights. She couldn't imagine not renewing, but he countered that he was owed, peace of mind. "It's not about you," she recalled, shouting across the kitchen bar. "Why do you think everything's about you, even this?" Mr. Unflappable slapped the kitchen bar top. "Who did they call when you couldn't leave the food court? And who did they call when—" "So this is about intrusions on your time?" She twisted a dish towel around one hand, tightening it until the blood bloomed under her skin.
"No, no, no, I'm not going to play that."
"No, no, no," she mimicked, feeling like an asshole, but feeling good, too, because the fight had been building for a week by that point. For a microsecond, she thought she caught a rage, bordering on hatred, slip through his eyes before he took a long, slow breath.
"An elevator doesn't go 60 miles an hour."
She was still back at that flash of rage. Was that the real Brian I just saw? Eventually, she realized it wouldn't return. Not today, anyway. She dropped the dish towel to the counter.
"What? You can't get mortally wounded if you have a panic attack in an elevator or a mall or, I don't know, in a park or walking down the street, but in a car?"
"It doesn't work that way. I don't have panic attacks when I'm driving."
"You only started having these things a few years ago. How do you know how the next one will manifest? I don't want to get the call that you're wrapped around a pole somewhere."
"Jesus." He said,
"Is it an unreasonable fear?"
"No," she admitted.
"Out of the realm of possibility?"
"No, it's not."
"What if you started having trouble breathing? You're sweating so hard you can't see through it, and you hit somebody in a crosswalk?"
"Now you're bullying."
"No, I'm just asking."
In the end, they reached a compromise. She renewed her license, but promised not to use it. But now that she'd strolled through a mall and ridden the subway, walked past Old South Church into Copley Square, taken a cab through the rain, and sat in a crowded basement bar, and all of it without a single uptick in her heart rate, not a single twitch in a throat vein, wouldn't it be cool to show up outside baggage claim at Logan? He'd freak, of course, but would his apprehension be overwhelmed by his pride? She went so far as to update her Zipcar account info. The credit card she'd first used had expired, but then remembered he'd driven himself to the airport and left the Infinity in long-term parking. So that was that. Her gratitude at being able to pass the cup induced some guilt. She felt gutless, weak, but maybe it was better she not drive, if even the scantest trepidation remained. When he came through the door, he wore the mildly surprised look of a man trying to reacquaint himself with the part of his life that didn't include airports and hotels and room service and constant change, but the opposite, routine. He glanced at the magazine basket she'd placed by the sofa as if he couldn't place it, because he couldn't. She'd purchased it while he was gone. He wheeled his suitcase to a corner and took off his copper raincoat and said,
"Hey,"
with an uncertain smile.
"Hey."
She hesitated before she crossed the apartment to him. If he'd been away for more than 24 hours, there was always a hiccup or two upon re-entry, an awkward stumble toward reassembly. He'd left their lives, after all, the things that defined them as we, which meant they each had spent the week becoming I. And just when that had become the new normal, he stepped back into the frame, and they tried to figure out where I ended and we began again. They kissed, and it was dry, almost chaste. "You tired?" she asked, because he looked it.
Yeah, I am.
He looked at his watch.
"It's, what, midnight over there?"
"I made you some dinner." He smiled broadly and easily, the first real Brian smile since he'd come through the door.
"No way. Going all domestic on me and whatnot? Thanks, babe."
He kissed her a second time, and this one had a little heat to it. She felt something loosen in her and returned the kiss in kind. They sat and ate salmon cooked in foil with brown rice and a salad. He asked her about her week, and she asked him about London and the conference, which apparently hadn't gone well.
"They set up these boards so they can convince the world they give a shit about the environment and the ethics of timber acquisition. Then they stack the board with industry assholes whose only ambition, besides sampling the local hookers, is to make sure nothing gets done."
He rubbed his eyes with the heels of his palms and sighed.
"It's, frustrating."
He looked down at his empty plate.
"You?"
"What about me?"
"You seemed off whenever we talked on the phone."
"No, I'm fine."
"Sure?"
"Uh-huh." As he yawned into his fist and gave her a weary smile, it was clear he didn't believe her.
"I'm gonna shower."
"Okay." He cleared their plates and put them in the dishwasher. As he headed for the bedroom, she said, "All right. You want to know?" He turned just short of the doorway and let loose a soft sigh of relief, held out his hands.
"That would be lovely."
"I saw your double."
"My double?"
She nodded, getting into a black Suburban behind the Hancock on Monday afternoon.
"When I was in the air?"
He stared back at her, confused.
"So, give me a sec here because I'm wiped. You saw a guy who looked like me, and..."
"No, I saw your double."
"So maybe you saw Scott..."
"Pfeiffer of Grafton, Vermont?" "I considered that. Problem was, this guy was also dressed in the exact same clothes you left the house in." He took that in with a slow nod.
"You didn't think you saw my double. You thought you saw me."
She poured them both a little more wine and brought his glass to him. She leaned against the back of the couch. He leaned against the door jamb.
"Yes."
"Ah." He closed his eyes and smiled, and a weight seemed to rise from his body and leave through the vent above him.
"So the weird tone and the selfie you wanted me to send, that was all because you thought..."
He opened his eyes.
"You thought what?"
"I didn't know what I thought."
"Well, you either thought Scott Pfeiffer made a trip into Boston or that I was lying about being out of the country."
"Something like that." It sounded so ridiculous now. He grimaced and drank some wine. "What?" she asked. "No, what?"
"You think that little of us?"
"No."
You thought I was living some kind of double life.
I definitely didn't say that.
Well, what else would it be? You claim you saw me on a street in Boston when I was on a 767 over probably, I don't know, Greenland by that point. So you grill me about where I am when I call from Heathrow, and you grill me about not charging my phone, and...
I didn't grill you.
No? And then you ask me to take a picture of myself so I can prove I'm, you know, exactly where I'd fucking said I'd be, and then you go out with my partner and, what, grill him too?
I'm not going to listen to this.
Why would you? You might actually have to take responsibility for acting like an asshole.
He lowered his head and held up a weary hand.
You know what? I'm tired. I'm not going to say anything helpful right now, and I need to, I don't know, process this, okay?
She tried to decide how angry she wanted to stay, and if she was mad at him or just herself. You called me an asshole.
No, I said you were acting like one.
A thin smile.
It's a small distinction, but a meaningful one.
She gave him back her own thin smile, placed a hand to his chest. Go take your shower. He closed the bedroom door behind him, and she could hear the water run. She found herself standing over his raincoat. She put her wine on a side table and wondered why she didn't feel guilt right now. She should. He was right. She'd walked down an insulting road thinking her husband of 2 years was so untrustworthy that he'd lie about which city he was in. But she didn't feel guilt. All week she'd told herself that what she'd seen had been an optical illusion. The selfie proved it. Their own history together, one in which she'd never known him to lie about anything, proved it. So why didn't she feel mistaken? Why didn't she feel guilty about mistrusting him? Not wholeheartedly, of course, not with full certitude, but just a little bit, just a niggling sense that all was not as it should be. She took his raincoat off the back of the chair where he'd left it, a pet peeve of hers. He couldn't just reach into the hall closet and hang it on a hanger. She reached into the left pocket and came back with an airline ticket. Heathrow to Logan, dated today, and some loose change. His passport was there, too. She opened it and rifled through the visa pages, which were cramped with stamps from all the countries he'd visited. Problem was, the stamps weren't in any kind of order. They seemed to show up on whichever page the immigration officer had decided to flip to that day. She listened to the muffled sound of the water running in the bathroom and continued to rifle the pages. Croatia, Greece, Russia, Germany, and then there it was. Heathrow on May 9th this year. She returned the passport to his coat and reached into the other pocket, a swipe card for the Covent Garden Hotel, 10 Monmouth Street, and a tiny receipt the size of her thumb for a news and magazine shop just up the street at 17 Monmouth. It was dated yesterday, 5-9-14, 11-12 in the morning, and gave evidence that Brian bought a newspaper, a pack of gum, and a bottle of Orangina, and paid with a 10-pound note and received £4.53 as change. The shower turned off. She put the swipe card back in the pocket of the coat and returned the coat to the back of the chair, but she slipped the receipt into the back pocket of her jeans. She had no idea why. Instinct. Chapter 17. Gaddis. Every year, on the anniversary of the night they met, Brian and Rachel return to the RR and dance to Since I Fell for You. If it could be found on a jukebox these days, it was usually the Johnny Mathis version. But the RR's jukebox had the original version, the granddaddy of them all by one-hit wonder Lenny Welch. It wasn't a love song so much as it was a loss song, the lament of someone trapped in a hopeless addiction to a heartless lover who will, there is no doubt, ultimately destroy him. Or her, depending on which version you listen to. Since their first dance to the song, they'd heard most of them. Nina Simone's, Dinah Washington's, Charlie Rich's, George Benson's, Gladys Knight's, Aaron Neville's, and Mavis Staples. And those were just the headliners. Rachel had once looked it up on iTunes and found 264 versions, performed by everyone from Louis Armstrong to Captain and Tennille. This year, Brian rented out the whole back room and invited some friends. Melissa showed up. So did Danny Marotta, Rachel's former cameraman at Six. Danny brought his wife Sandra, and Sandra brought a co-worker, Liz. Annie, Darla, and Rodney, who'd all accepted buyouts from the Globe in the years since she'd left, dropped by. Caleb showed up with Haya, somehow dressed to lay waste in a simple black cotton sheath dress and black flats, black hair swept back off the curve of her elegant neck in an updo, and all of her made somehow earthier and even sexier by the baby on her hip. The perfect baby, by the way. The dark good looks of both parents fused into a child with the most symmetrical face, eyes of warm black oil, skin the color of desert sand just after sundown. Rachel caught Brian, usually circumspect in such matters, pushing his eyeballs back into his head a few times when Haya and A.B. passed by, like some fantastical humans who'd stepped from a creation myth. Haya got some of the youngest guys, Brian and Caleb's latest interns, no point in learning their names, they'd be replaced with new ones the next time she looked, to take long looks, even though all their female counterparts were blindingly pretty and flush with firm, unblemished early 20s flesh. On another night, Rachel might have felt a twinge of jealousy, or at least competitive edge. The woman had just given fucking birth, for Christ's sake, and she looked ready for the center spread in a lingerie catalog. But tonight, she knew how good she looked. Not in an advertising of the wares way, but in an elegant, understated way that told everyone in the room she didn't feel any need to trumpet what God had placed in good proportion in the first place, and which genetics, and Pilates, were leaving thus far in place. She and Haya caught up by the bar at one point, as A.B. slept in the car seat at her mother's feet. Because of the language barrier, they'd rarely spoken other than a few passing hellos, and had hardly seen each other in a year, but Caleb had said Haya's grasp of English was vastly improved. Rachel decided to brave the waters, and found that he hadn't been exaggerating. Haya now spoke well, if deliberately.
"How are you?"
"I am happy. How are you?"
"Great. How's Annabelle?"
"She is fussy."
Rachel glanced down at the child sleeping in her seat in the middle of a party. Earlier, while she'd been on Haya's hip, she'd never once squawked or even squirmed. Haya stared back at Rachel, her beautiful face a blank, her lips set.
"Thank you so much for coming," Rachel said eventually.
"Yes, he is my husband."
"That's why you came?" Rachel felt a small smile tug her lips. "Because he's your husband?"
"Yes."
Haya's eyes narrowed in confusion. It made Rachel feel guilty, as if she were bullying the woman over language and cultural barriers.
"You look very beautiful, Rachel."
"Thank you. So do you."
Haya looked at the baby at her feet.
"She is waking."
Rachel had no idea how she predicted it, but about 5 seconds later, Annabelle's eyes popped open. Rachel squatted by her. She never knew what to say to babies. She'd watched people over the years interact with them in a way she found unnatural, jabbering in that infantile tone of voice no one ever adopted unless they were talking to babies, animals, or the very old and infirm.
"Hello,"
she said to Annabelle. The child stared back at her with her mother's eyes, so clear and untainted by skepticism or irony that Rachel couldn't help but feel judged by them. She placed one finger on Annabelle's chest, and the child closed her hand around it and tugged.
"You've got a strong grip," Rachel said.
Annabelle let go of her finger and looked up at the cowl of her car seat with a hint of distress, as if she were surprised to find it there. Her face crumpled, and Rachel only had time to say, "No, no," before Annabelle wailed. Haya's shoulder brushed Rachel's as she reached for the handle of the car seat. She lifted the seat up onto the bar. She rocked the seat back and forth, and the baby immediately stopped crying, and Rachel felt embarrassed and incompetent.
You have a gift with her, she said.
I am her mother.
Again, Haya looked a bit confused.
She is tired, hungry.
Of course, Rachel said, because it seemed to be the kind of thing one said.
We must go. Thank you for asking us to your party.
Haya lifted her daughter from the seat and held her to her shoulder, the baby's cheek pressed to the side of her neck. Both mother and daughter looked of a piece, as if they shared the same lungs, saw through the same eyes. It made Rachel and her party seem frivolous and a little sad. Caleb came over to gather the car seat and pink baby bag and white muslin blanket. Then he walked his wife and daughter out to the car and kissed them both goodnight. Rachel watched them through the window and knew she didn't want what they had. On the other hand, she knew that she did.
Look at you,
Brian said when someone, Rachel suspected Melissa, put a dollar in the jukebox and pressed B17, Since I Fell for You, and they were compelled to dance to it a second time that night. He raised his eyebrows at their reflection in the full-length mirror on the back wall, and she saw herself head-on. She was surprised, as she always was in the very first millisecond of seeing herself, that she was no longer 23. Someone had once told her that everyone had a fixed age in their mind's eye image of themselves. For some, it was 15 or 50, but everyone had one. Rachel's was 23. Her face had, of course, grown longer and more lined in the ensuing 14 years. Her eyes had changed, not the gray-green of them, but they were less sure and less adrenalized. Her hair, so dark a shade of cherry it looked black in most lights, was cut short with a side bang, a look that softened the harder curves of her heart-shaped face. Or so a producer had once told her when he convinced her to not only cut her hair but straighten it. Before that conversation, it had always been a long tangle that fell to her shoulders, but the producer, after prefacing his critique with "no offense," words that always preceded something offensive, told her, "You're a few steps short of beautiful, but the camera doesn't know that. The camera loves you, and that's making our bosses love you." That producer was, of course, Sebastian. She thought so much of herself that she married him. As she and Brian swayed on the dance floor, she acknowledged what a huge improvement he was over Sebastian, a step up in every way, better looking, kinder, better conversationalist, funnier, and smarter, even though he tried to downplay that part of his makeup, whereas Sebastian always played it up. But there was the issue of trust again. Say what you would about Sebastian being an asshole, but he was a genuine asshole. Such an asshole that he didn't think he had to hide the fact. Sebastian didn't hide anything. On the other hand, with Brian, she didn't know what she had lately. Things had been unnervingly polite between them since he'd returned from his trip. She had nothing to support her mistrust, so she didn't press the issue. And he seemed fine with that. And yet they moved around each other in the apartment like they were circling a jar of anthrax. They pulled up short in conversations lest they say something that could lead to conflict. His habit of leaving yesterday's clothes hanging over the bedpost, her predilection for not changing the toilet paper roll if there was still one square left stuck to the cardboard, and chose their words with ultimate care. Soon they'd stop discussing potential spots of tension altogether, which would only lead to resentment. They smiled distantly at each other in the morning, smiled distantly at each other in the evening, spent more time on their laptops or their cells. In the past week, they'd made love once, and it was the carnal version of their distant smiles, as binding as water, as intimate as junk mail. When the song ended, the group clapped, and a few whistled, and Melissa tapped a fork into her wine glass and shouted, "Kiss! Kiss!" until they finally obliged. "How self-conscious do you feel right now?" she asked Brian as she leaned back in his arms. Brian didn't reply. He was trying to make sense of something behind her. She turned as his fingers parted, and she stepped out of his grip. A man had entered the room. He was in his early 50s, with long gray hair tied back in a ponytail, quite skinny. He wore a gray, unstructured sport coat over a blue and white Hawaiian shirt and dark jeans. His skin was leathery and tan. His blue eyes were so bright, they looked aflame.
Brian!
He opened his arms. Brian exchanged a quick glance with Caleb. It was so fast that if Rachel hadn't been standing 3 inches from his face, she would have missed it. And then a smile flooded his face, and he approached the man.
Andrew!
He grasped the man behind his elbow with one hand while shaking his hand with the other.
What brings you to Boston? A show at the Lyric.
Andrew raised his eyebrows.
That's great.
It is.
Isn't it?
Andrew shrugged.
It's a job.
Caleb walked a pair of drinks over.
Andrew Gaddis, back in the house. Stoli still your poison?
Andrew drained the drink in one swallow and handed the glass back to Caleb. He took the second drink from him, nodded his thanks, and took a moderate sip.
Good to see you.
You too.
Andrew chuckled.
It is.
Caleb laughed and clapped him on the shoulder.
That seems to be your line tonight.
Andrew, my wife, Rachel.
Rachel shook Andrew Gaddis's hand. It was surprisingly smooth, even delicate.
A pleasure, Rachel.
He gave her a knowing, reckless smile.
You're smart.
She laughed. I'm sorry?
You're smart.
He was still shaking her hand.
I can see that. Shit, anyone can. The beauty I get. Brian always liked beauty, but the...
Play nice,
Brian said.
Brains, that's a new one.
Hey, Andrew.
Brian's voice was very light.
Hey, Brian.
He let go of her hand, but kept his eyes on hers.
Still smoke?
I vape.
Me too.
No shit.
Care to join me for one on the sidewalk?
Andrew Gaddis cocked his head at Rachel.
Think I should?
What?
Join your husband for a vape.
Why not? She said. For old times, you can catch up. He looked around the room, then back at her.
What were you dancing to?
Since I fell for you.
Who would dance to that?
Andrew gave them both a big, baffled smile.
It's a hopeless song. It's all about emotional imprisonment.
Rachel nodded. We're trying to be post-ironic, I think. Or meta-romantic. I can never decide which. Enjoy your vape, Andrew. He tipped an imaginary hat to her and turned toward Brian and Caleb. The three of them headed for the door, but Andrew Gaddis suddenly turned back. He said to Rachel,
Google it.
What? Brian and Caleb, almost at the door, noticed he wasn't with them.
Since I fell for you, Google it.
There's about 200 covers of it, I know.
I'm not talking about the song.
Brian headed back toward them, and Andrew sensed it. He pivoted and met Brian halfway across the floor, and they went outside to smoke. She watched them on the street, all three of them exhaling their vapor. They laughed a lot, like the dearest of old friends, and there was a lot of bro-fection, fist-bumping, shoulder-slapping, pushing. At one point, Brian grabbed Andrew by the back of the neck and pulled him in so their foreheads were touching. They were both smiling, laughing, actually, Brian's lips going a mile a minute, and the two of them nodding with their heads adhered like Siamese twins. When they broke the clinch, the smiles died for a moment, and then Brian looked in the window and caught Rachel's eyes and gave her a thumbs up as if to say, "It's all okay, it's all okay." This is a man, she reminded herself, who would literally give you the coat off his back. When they returned, Andrew seemed interested in everyone in the room but Rachel. He flirted with one of Delacroix Lumber's employees for a while, chatted up Melissa, spent a fair amount of time talking to Caleb, both of them wearing very somber expressions, and he got drunk with exceptional speed. Within an hour of arriving, he took one step sideways for every 5 steps forward.
He never could handle his liquor.
Brian said after Andrew knocked one of the intern's bags off the back of a chair and then toppled the chair trying to remedy the situation. When the chair fell, everyone laughed, though few seemed to find it funny.
A buzzkill, this guy, Brian said. Always has been.
How do you know him? Rachel asked. Brian didn't hear her.
Let me deal with this.
He walked on over and helped Andrew right the chair. He put a hand on his arm, and Andrew yanked the arm back, knocking a half-full glass of beer off the bar in the process.
You fuck.